Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. We will get started in just a few minutes. Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us. We will get started in just a couple minutes. All right, I think we can go ahead and get started. Hello, my name is Paul Bierman, Director of Education and Events for SNEB. Welcome to today's Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior Journal Club webinar, part of a series of 11 webinars with a focus on nutrition education programs and implications from the field. Special thank you to the SNEB Food and Nutrition Extension Education Division for helping select articles from the journal showcasing the work of cooperative extension nutrition educators. As the official peer-reviewed journal of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior, GNEB advances nutrition education and behavior-related research, practice, and policy. Before we begin, I have a few pieces of information to review. We will take questions at the end of the presentation. Throughout the presentation, please type any questions you may have into the Q&A section that you can find at the bottom of your screen, and they will be moderated out. When the webinar ends today, you'll be prompted to complete a short survey. Please take a moment to complete that survey, as your feedback is greatly appreciated for planning future SNEB webinars. This webinar is being recorded and will be available free of charge to SNEB members under the webinar section of the website. Finally, watch for a follow-up email to be sent in the next few days, which will include a link to the recording for this session, the handouts, and your CEU certificate for your attendance today. I can now hand things over to our moderator, Dr. Kristen DiFilippo, Teaching Assistant Professor at the University of Illinois. Kristen?
Thank you, Paul. Today, I have the privilege of introducing our speaker. Samara Sterling is a nutrition scientist and research director for the Peanut Institute. She has expertise in the use of plant-based nutrition for the prevention and treatment of chronic diseases. She also functions as a principal investigator and director for clinical nutrition and lifestyle interventions, examining strategies to improve health in at-risk communities. She regularly speaks for both national and international audiences and is passionate about translating science into community or into consumer-friendly messages. I want to thank her for sharing her expertise with us today. And at this point, I can pass it over to our speaker.
Thank you, Kristen, for the invitation to be here with you today. I am excited to speak about some of the work that my team and I have been doing, particularly in the Deep South. My co-investigator, Shelly-Ann Bowen, could not be here with me today, but she also sends her well wishes. So thank you all for being here. You'll see the title on the screen, Effect of a Plant-Based Dietary Intervention Among Black Adults in the Deep South. And here's just a look at the competencies that this webinar will be covering, particularly for this audience: basic food and nutrition knowledge, behavior and education theory, and nutrition education program. As far as my disclosures, I do not have any relevant disclosures or conflicts of interest related to this presentation. So, by way of background or outline, we will go through the introduction of the study, background and gaps. I'll talk a bit about the conceptual framework, methods, results, and discussion. And these are the objectives by the end of this session, just getting a better idea of the Veggie and Soul program, looking at the process and outcomes of the program, and then the importance of integrating a cultural framework in future nutrition and lifestyle interventions in the Deep South. So I wanted to start with this picture here, and I'll go back. I wanted to start with this picture, which is an advertisement from the 1950s. And when I looked at it, I thought it was so interesting because you look at these ads, look at the one on the left. It says, if you want to be popular, you can't afford to be skinny. And you see this woman there, and she is advertising that women everywhere need to take these supplements called Weight On, because if you take this supplement, it'll help you put some weight on and you'll be popular, right? And then you look at the one on the right, which I thought was so funny, because you see a woman and her friend at the beach enjoying themselves, but she, the one who is apparently not full enough, says, "No one talks to me when I'm at the beach." And her friend says, "Well, you really need to try these supplements. You need to try ironized yeast. That's what helped me get popular." And then 4 weeks later, her friend tries it, and she's almost now too popular at the beach. I think ads like these are important to look at where we have come as a society and the transformations that have happened over time in our perceptions and in the way that we understand not only physical beauty, but health in general. You fast forward all these decades later, and we recognize that not only did we put weight on, it's as if, in fact, we are unable to keep that weight stabilized. So if you look at, and I know that we have seen these charts before, I assume that many of us have seen these charts before, but if you look at the map on 2011, these are just 10-year differences. And what you find, unfortunately, is that there really wasn't much of a change in some of the prevalences. The only thing that happened was that we gained more and more weight, right? So in 2011, no state had a prevalence of obesity less than 20%. And in 2021, all states and territories had more than 20% of adults with obesity. And when we look specifically at the South, in 2011, the South had the highest prevalence of obesity, about 30%. The only difference is that in 2021, the South was now at 36%. And then we see the same trend with the Midwest and the Northeast and the West following. So we have made some progress, but unfortunately not enough. So when we think about what needs to happen for that progress to be made, as nutrition and public health professionals, we recognize that something really does have to change. And in terms of what needs to change, the idea of that may vary across professionals and across organizations, but in general, we are all sort of coming to a bit of a consensus that significant dietary shifts are needed to address our public health crisis. And this statement here is from Dr. Walt Willett, who led the famous Eat Lancet report with other scientists across the globe. And basically, as we look at the fact that if we are going to feed a growing population by 2050, it's going to require some really key transformations in our dietary patterns. Doubling our consumption of nuts and legumes and halving our consumption of red meat and sugar. And in general, a diet that's richer in plant-based foods with fewer animal-source foods. It seems as if moving in that direction confers both improved health and environmental benefits. And of course, I put that picture of Ozempic there because we recognize as a society that something needs to change. And so people are looking for quick fix methods. However, we recognize that the quick fix methods, they may be effective in the short term, but in terms of long-term responses and sustained changes, we'll really need to take a look at either a combination of the pharmaceutical approaches and dietary behaviors, or really have some substantial shifts in lifestyle. Now, when we think about what those shifts look like, and you look at the dietary guidelines, for example, the most recent one in 2020 to 25, they're working on the other iteration right now. But you look at the dietary patterns in general that are recommended. You've got the US style dietary pattern, which maybe a little bit vague for some of us. Then you have the healthy vegetarian dietary pattern. Then there's the DASH diet. And then you have this region-specific slash cultural-specific dietary pattern, the healthy Mediterranean-style dietary pattern. And it focuses on foods that are in countries surrounded by the Mediterranean Sea. And I have also been to the Mediterranean. I love Mediterranean food. And I think it is, the dietary pattern is so fresh there. However, what we see, what is happening here in the United States, is that we do have a need for cultural inclusivity in our recommendations. Because as much as the Mediterranean diet is celebrated, not just in research, but even as you see in social rankings like the US World News and Report, We see that there are other dietary patterns that are cultural in nature that are less well represented and are not celebrated at all. You see this news article that basically the headline is Southern cooking is what's killing African Americans, right? Of course, they use the term maybe killing what's African Americans, but for the general public, when they look at a headline like this, what do you think about your culture? And you go, man, okay. What's happening? Okay, so the Mediterranean diet is good, but my diet is just bad, all bad, all bad. And the key point I want to bring out on this slide is that while a Southern style dietary pattern has been characterized by high intake of red and processed meats and sugary foods, the original study, it's called the REGARD study, and I was privileged to be introduced to it when I did my PhD at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. One of my mentors was one of the PIs on this study. But the study itself actually didn't reflect much of the headlines that we saw in the media because the study also showed that a more plant-based dietary pattern was common among older female Black participants, but that's not a headline that we heard very much. And so what can that do for people who are not from the Mediterranean or who may not have access to the Mediterranean diet? You start asking yourself, well, where does my culture fit into all of this? That means I probably need to throw out all of my cultural foods, right? But we know that that's not the case. And old ways, cultural food traditions, they have done a lot of work. They're a nonprofit based in Boston, Massachusetts, and they've done a lot of work on traditional heritage dietary patterns that many of which have been shown to provide significant health benefits. And there was a wonderful paper that they did that came out last week, just last week, which explores a perspective beyond the Mediterranean diet. So looking at Latin American, Asian, and African heritage diets and recognizing that there are foods within cultural dietary patterns that should be celebrated, that should be highlighted, even if there are dietary changes that are needed within a specific population, that the way to do it is really to emphasize the traditional foods that are already nutrient dense and present within that dietary pattern. And in fact, there are a few studies, I didn't have the time to go through all of them, but let's just say there's a wealth of data that looks at, that explores things like dietary preferences among adults living in the Deep South or of Black or African American heritage. And here's one study, earlier study a few years ago, older study now, but this study looked at European Americans living in the Deep South versus African Americans living in the Deep South. And what you noticed was that for African Americans, they were likely to describe collard greens, turnip greens, cabbage as their favorite foods. They may not necessarily have described something like salad as their favorite foods, but you see a very sort of vegetable-rich culture there. And that is something that we can highlight. And there was another one where, for African Americans living in the Southwest, I think this one was done in Texas, greens, okra, corn, tomato, grits, sweet potatoes. These were eaten even a bit more frequently by the population living in that vicinity. And so that gives us a clue that when we are organizing interventions and really creating them to tailor to populations living in various regions of the United States, that we can tap into culture. And instead of pushing a narrative that says, well, you've got to adopt the Mediterranean diet, or you've got to adopt some other inaccessible diet to you, or something that you may not even like, that we can highlight some of the foods that are rich in the culture while even introducing some newer foods. The other point that I want to make here is that over time, and this data is from 2020, but over time, what we've been seeing is that there is a movement back to plant-forward eating, like we've seen with the African traditional heritage diets in the Black community. In fact, Black Americans are the fastest growing vegan population in the United States. Recent reports say that as well. And there was a poll in 2020 that even showed that 31% of non-white Americans had reduced their meat consumption in the past year, compared to only 19% of white Americans. And Black Americans, you see even BBC News advertising that Black Americans are more likely to be vegan. And we see pop-ups of restaurants all over. Why is this significant? It's because we've seen in the literature that a fully plant-based diet is the only dietary pattern that has been shown consistently to not just prevent heart disease, not just reduce the risk for heart disease, but actually reverse heart disease. And this comes from the early Dean Ornish study that showed a reversion of atherosclerotic plaque in individuals after a year and after 5 years of following a low-fat vegan diet. And even the more recent portfolio diet study out of the University of Toronto has shown a significant decrease in cholesterol markers comparable to statin drugs after just 4 weeks of following the dietary pattern. We also see reduction in risk of type 2 diabetes, cancer, kidney disease, and obesity with a fully plant-based diet. And so the idea here is if African Americans are the fastest growing vegan population and are already sort of trending in this direction, back to not something novel, but something that is sort of embedded within the traditional African heritage diet, then is there a way that we can incorporate that within interventions to see even more success in dietary behaviors? So, as I mentioned before, we've seen that these dietary patterns may reduce cardiovascular disease risk. But what my team and I noticed was that there really weren't that many interventions looking at the integration of plant-based nutrition and lifestyle in rural Black communities. Thankfully, there was a NuSoul study that was based out of South Carolina, but that one, there were some differences with that one, and that one was also in a bit more of an urban setting than the deep South rural setting that we were targeting. And so our idea was, well, how can we intervene in a way that honors the culture? And as you can see, I put some pictures of restaurants that are not that far from where the study was based in Albany, Georgia. Slutty Vegan is very big in Atlanta. And then, of course, you've got Ethiopian food and even some soulful flavors, a restaurant there called Soul Vegetarian. So the aim of this study was to, it was a pilot study. So first it was exploring the feasibility and acceptability of the intervention. And then we also looked at some clinical and behavioral outcomes. This intervention was remotely delivered, culturally tailored, and it was a plant-based nutrition and lifestyle intervention among Black adults in a rural Deep South or Black Belt community. Our goals, we wanted to educate the population of the benefits of a healthy diet and to encourage the increased consumption of plant food. So that's really important because our aim was not to convert everyone to a fully plant-based diet. Everybody's going to be vegan forever and ever after this. That wasn't our aim. The aim was to introduce the lifestyle with the aim of increasing consumption of plant-based foods as a result. And you'll see the conceptual frameworks there. We used a variety of models, such as the socioecological model. And then, of course, community-based participatory research was a part of our process. And we have a four-pronged approach here in terms of how we viewed getting to that place of success with our outcomes, plant-based nutrition, also incorporating physical activity and wellness, social and community support, and then cultural adaptability, or what I also like to call cultural palatability. So, what exactly do we mean when we talk about cultural adaptability or cultural palatability? The idea here through this intervention was first to highlight, as I talked about before, highlight some of those nutrient-dense plant foods that are already popular within a cultural context where we were. So in other words, if people don't like kale, that's okay. You can have collard greens, right? And then celebrating the rich flavors of newer food items that are introduced. So, for example, using some of those herbs and spices within African American culture, that's something that's big, right? So making sure that the food is flavorful, introduction of even newer herbs, spices, sauces, low sodium version for common seasonings that are used. And then we move to the aspect of teaching best practices because there are things to teach, right? In terms of how to enhance the nutrient density of each meal. So whether that's steaming vegetables instead of frying them, plate portions, and being more plant-centric. So this is how we sort of acknowledge cultural adaptability or palatability within the framework of this study. So in terms of our methods, the setting was in a Black Belt community in Albany, Georgia. And in Albany, Georgia, most of the, and I'm not sure what happened to Albany, Georgia at the top. Albany, Georgia should have been listed there at the top. But Albany, Georgia is part of the Black Belt community. And this describes communities that are not only rich in dark soil, but where greater than 50% of the population identifies as either Black or African American. So in Albany, Georgia, and I do live here now, 73% of the population is Black. Top three causes of death among Black individuals, you've got diabetes, hypertension, and heart disease. And according to USDA, much of Albany is situated in low-income areas. So we did have some partnerships throughout the whole thing. Our funding came from the American Heart Association, Phoebe Hospital, and Aramark. And then we also had some in-kind donations. Oh, yes. And the Department of Public Health and Walmart. They were also funders. And then we also had some partnerships with food organizations that provided in-kind donations. And as I mentioned before, we were focusing on 100% plants within this dietary pattern. We emphasize familiar plant foods. And then we also introduce some of the less common ones. Things like lentils, garbanzo beans, mushrooms, and some of the dairy alternatives or meat alternatives that folks may find in the supermarket. Components of the intervention, it was 12 weeks, and we had weekly Monday night educational classes, which I'll get a little bit more into. The intervention also consisted of support groups and health leaders, so we trained community members to be leaders of that particular section. Facebook groups for motivation, weekly plant-based meals. So the participants received that. They also received weekly grocery boxes, bi-weekly produce boxes. So we partnered with a community garden leader here in Albany, and he actually taught people how to garden in their homes and gave them produce as well. They had optional meal plans. Those were written by one of our dietetic interns. Intake and final surveys, dietary assessments, and biomedical measurements. And I put grassroots model at the bottom because, again, this wasn't started. I live and work in Albany, Georgia. And so this was grassroots in terms of bringing the community together and saying, hey, what can we do about the situation in Albany? Let's work together. And that's how we were able to build it up. And we still continue to do some of that work today. The outcomes that we were looking at, of course, as a pilot study, first and foremost, feasibility, acceptability, and retention. I've mentioned that first, but when I talk about the results, I'll talk about that feasibility and acceptability last. And then clinical outcomes related to cardiovascular disease, we were looking at that. We also looked at inflammatory biomarkers like high-sensitivity C-reactive protein and TMAO. And then dietary behaviors, we used some validated surveys to be able to take a look at that. And then we also did 6-month post-intervention surveys. Our inclusion and exclusion criteria, we utilized a convenient sample of 24 participants in the local community, and they were gathered through social media, word of mouth, clinics, offices, et cetera, wherever we could find them. Inclusion must identify as Black or African American, and we did utilize BMI as a risk factor for cardiovascular disease, recognizing that that's not necessarily a perfect measurement within the Black community, but over 25 BMI, that was an inclusion criteria, and then having internet access to be able to join in on the Zoom meetings each week. Exclusion criteria, if they were already following a plant-based diet, they were excluded. If they were already on a weight loss program, or if they were pregnant, they were excluded. Here's a look at one of our community partnerships. So this is also an organization that I helped to create, which was a plant-based nonprofit organization that, and it's still in existence, we just sort of changed the name a bit, provided plant-based soul food meals to residents in the Albany, Georgia community. And you can see here that particularly during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, we would get together and our chef, who is in green over here, he's actually a chef here in Albany, and now he does vegan catering. Before he came to us, he was doing a lot more of just regular food in general, but now his food is a bit more health conscious. So we would prepare the food. People would have an opportunity to order the food, provide a donation if they can. If they couldn't, they were able to get the food for free, and we would deliver the food to their cars as they came through. So that organization partnered heavily with this program to be able to make it a success. In terms of our surveys and assessments, so this is the hospital that we partnered with, Phoebe Hospital. It's our only one in Albany, Georgia, as is common in rural communities. Sometimes you only have one hospital. So at baseline, of course, we did informed consent. And then both at baseline and at 12 weeks, we had the surveys, assessments, and clinical measurements. And we used PEER-T tests mostly to examine pre-intervention and post-intervention differences. I just wanted to show you a bit of how that intervention was delivered. So you can see that we had a community leader. He was a local pastor, well-respected in the community, and he was trained. We wrote the intervention. He was trained to deliver that intervention and deliver the education. You saw him in the middle doing some stretches. That's because at the end, we had an exercise session. And then we even had a local farmer in the community here who showed participants how to grow food in their backyards, different from the other farmer that I mentioned before. So right now, what he's actually showing is how to grow blueberries, and he is showing them how they can actually do that. You'll see the blueberries right there growing in his own backyard. So that was motivational for the participants, and we had a series of lessons that covered dietary patterns, how to eat a healthy diet, how to read nutrition facts labels, staying the course in terms of the behaviors and the goals that you set. We also had community health leaders. Here's just a look at all of them. And of course, yes, our farmer was one of them as well. So they were responsible for motivating participants throughout the intervention, leading breakout groups for the Monday night sessions. They shared their expertise, recipes, and most importantly, they were there to build a sense of togetherness within their team. So we even had little friendly competitions across the teams, and that helped with the social support element because that was a key element of the structure of our program. And then we did have chef-taught cook-along classes. So these were done over our private Facebook group. On the top, you see Chef Daniels. He's preparing vegan crab cakes. These are made from chickpeas and hearts of palm. You see one of the participants cooking along with him, and here's how they plated theirs. And on the bottom, you see the buffalo tofu bites. Those, of course, are made from tofu with some buffalo sauce, a cashew-based ranch dressing, and some veggies on the side. And then you also see just a look at our weekly food and meals and recipes. So they did have plant-based tastings every Saturday. So that local restaurant that I mentioned to you before, that nonprofit organization, prepared various meals. They also received these grocery boxes here. Goya was such an integral partner. You can see we got a lot of stuff from Goya. Beans were really promoted as sort of the main source of protein, and we were able to integrate that within the recipes themselves. So things like gumbo and chili and southern black-eyed peas, those were part of our recipes. And whenever we had the produce from the community garden, we tried to make sure that the recipes that we gave, as you can see here on the bottom, that those recipes coincided with the produce that they were getting. So here you'll see that they had some sweet potato, and they also had collard greens. So you'll see a recipe here for collard greens, and here's a vegan sausage sheet meal that contains sweet potato. So that's a look at sort of the methods that we used within the project. What were our results? What did we actually see? So just taking a look at the demographics, we had an average age of 43 in our group, and most of our folks were significantly overweight. Average BMI was 43.1. So as I mentioned before, as we used BMI as one of those inclusion criteria, and I mentioned that that's not necessarily, there are some limitations with that for the African-American community, but we recognize that within the scientific literature, once you get over a certain BMI, over 30 or so, it tends to be pretty consistent in terms of cardiovascular risk. So we did have an average BMI of 43.1. We had mostly females in this program. We really only had two males. And we had an even spread across income and educational levels. So that was good. And then a third of our participants reported having some form of food insecurity. And we did measure that through the USDA Food Security Survey. So what did we see in terms of the clinical outcomes? And I meant to highlight a few sections here, but the main thing that we saw was a significant reduction in BMI. Weight loss was averaged 10 pounds for the 12 weeks. And for cholesterol, we saw 10% reduction total cholesterol, 13% reduction LDL cholesterol, and then a 25% reduction in high sensitivity C-reactive protein, which is a specific inflammatory biomarker for cardiovascular disease risk. And we also saw a trend in reduction for TMAO, but this was not significant. Notably here, I will mention that there was a lab error because we used a lab, I won't say their name, but we used a lab, a community lab here, and they weren't as familiar with this particular measurement. So there was some error that happened within that. So we really only had a sample size of 17 there. So this is something that we'd probably repeat in the future. So our behavioral outcomes, so diet and physical activity. In our dietary behavior survey, when we asked participants how many daily servings of fruit they ate at baseline, you can see that that number was 1.3 and it doubled after 12 weeks. That was significant. Vegetable consumption was also significantly improved, about that was almost 100% as well. And then a 90% increase in whole grain consumption before and after the intervention. And then we also had, and this is using ASA24, which is a 24-hour dietary recall system to take that dietary behavior. So we saw a consumption of nutrients to limit significantly decrease over the course of the intervention as well. So you can see cholesterol, of course, if they're consuming mostly plant-based foods, then cholesterol is going to significantly decrease. Significant reduction in saturated fat, sodium was also significantly reduced, and then added sugars. Caffeine was really interesting because we weren't really targeting caffeine at all, but I suppose that with a reduction in coffee and sugar, then people just probably discarded the coffee altogether, and then their reduction in caffeine was seen. From the American Heart Association survey, we also saw improvements in terms of confidence to plan and prepare nutritious meals. So participants were saying that they felt like they could plan more meals before grocery shopping. They could read nutrition facts labels better. They could use a grocery list more often. They felt more comfortable or confident in terms of preparing healthy meals as a result of the intervention. This one was really interesting because at the beginning, we used a validated survey to ask participants to agree or disagree with this statement using a Likert scale. And the statement was a diet without meat is satisfactory and nutritious. And at baseline, you can see it was, you know, sort of half-half, less than 50% of folks agreed or strongly agreed with that statement. More than likely, they were neutral or disagreed with that statement. But by the end of the intervention, we saw a significant improvement in terms of that attitude towards plant-based dietary patterns. So by the end, 95% of participants agreed or strongly agreed with that statement, and only 5% were neutral towards it. I believe that was just one person, one or two people. I also just wanted to show this because we did incorporate physical activity within the intervention as far as part of that four-pronged approach that I showed you in the beginning. So basically what we saw here was particularly an improvement in vigorous physical activity over the course of the intervention and the number of occasions that people reported engaging in walking activity. So this they reported walking for more days each week post-intervention than they did pre-intervention. So I mentioned before that I would talk about the feasibility and acceptability last. So here it is. The program feasibility and acceptability, we did find based on the survey that the program was highly rated among participants. We had a mean weekly attendance of 93%, and we had a food and grocery box redemption at 98%. And I always say, whenever I look at that figure, I think, well, of course, I mean, if I'm getting free food, I'm going to redeem that free food, because we were giving away a lot of good stuff. And even after the intervention, I'll say that folks still had some stuff left over, particularly of the beans, the canned beans and the dry beans, because we were fortunate enough to get a lot of donations, particularly during that time. When we asked folks about their top motivators for engaging and remaining in the program, they cited the top three were lesson content, food and grocery boxes, and virtual support groups. So they really appreciated the fact that we took our time in engaging in the lessons. And one of the things that we emphasized, because we built those lessons ourselves, is that we emphasize sort of a visual approach to the lessons. So the lessons were colorful, they were exciting, they were engaging. At the beginning of each class, we had shout out sections where we celebrated folks who may have posted pictures of their plant-based foods, or they posted pictures of themselves exercising. And then as we got into the lesson content, we trained our community leaders on those breakout sessions. So we wouldn't just be giving information. We would be asking questions like, in those great breakout groups, what was the most challenging for you this week? Where were your successes this week? And what are some advices, or what is some advice that you can give to your other team members about how you got through a particular challenge? So the social support element was built within the lesson content itself, and that made participants feel as though they were a part of something. They literally felt, and we heard this very much, they felt like they were a part of a family, like they were a part of just a close-knit group that were there to help to encourage them along the way. And then I already mentioned the food and grocery boxes. The only other thing that I'll say about the virtual support groups is that the Facebook group, we found that to be a really key feature in our program, because especially since it was remotely delivered, yes, we had the community leaders reaching out to their participants or their group members throughout the intervention. However, having that Facebook group where everyone was a part of it, you saw people posting, you saw people asking questions, it just built that sense of togetherness. The most highly rated meals, and we did do some recipe testing and all of that, we had to move at a pretty quick pace. But the most highly rated meals were the lasagna, the black bean burgers, and the lentil meatloaf. And what you'll notice in each of those recipes, these weren't necessarily utilizing meat alternatives. And I'll talk about that in a little bit, but the meat alternatives, like the meat analogs, let's say like Beyond or Impossible or another veggie burger that you can get in the store, we didn't necessarily cut that out. In fact, we did get some donations from an organization that was starting up in that. However, you can see the most highly rated meals included beans, lentils. That lasagna was actually made from lentils as well. That was the main protein source in there, and that's what people enjoyed. So for the 6-month follow-up survey, we did have a 75% response rate. And interestingly, as I showed you that graph before, where 94%, or it was actually 95% at the end of the intervention, agreed that a diet without meat is satisfactory and nutritious, at 6 months, we had a similar response. And that was really encouraging for us to see. Based on their self-reported dietary behaviors, participants reported maintaining both their fruit and vegetable consumption at 6 months compared to 12 weeks. Now, and we did measure that 2.6 servings and 3.0 servings for vegetables. Now, when it came on, and you'll remember me saying that our eventual aim was not that everybody is just vegan, right? But what we did find, we found success in terms of people eating more plant-based foods even after 6 months. So about half reported eating more plant-based foods since the program. And we even had a third of people who said that they were consuming a fully or mostly plant-based dietary pattern even after the program. And even to this day, just because I live and work in the community, even to this day, folks are asking, "Hey, when are we going to do, when are you going to do another one of these?" And I'm still eating plant-based. And we've actually had efforts to where we've been able to even ask our grocery stores to carry more plant-forward products. The main common barrier that was reported at 6 months was social support. And I can't emphasize how much of a positive that was for our program, specifically within a Deep South context. Social support was key. We heard this a lot. I need the motivation and encouragement to keep it up. So that's one of the things that we recognize. As we move into the discussion, I want to mention that we've looked at other studies in the past that have done similar programs. Here's one that was done in Chicago, Dr. Kim Williams. I believe this was at Rush University. And they had 21 African Americans in a 15-day program, and they saw average weight loss of even close to 6 pounds. Total cholesterol was reduced, blood pressure was reduced. There was also another one similar to that. And I forget where that one was, but 5 week intervention in 53 volunteers, and they saw a reduction in insulin, hemoglobin A1C, and even TMAO, which we saw a trend in decrease towards there, but that wasn't significant for us. The one that I do want to mention is that more recently, Dr. Turner McGreevy did another study, a 2 year intervention, a randomized control trial, where she compared a low fat vegan diet to a low fat omnivorous diet. And she didn't really see too much of a difference in terms of weight loss and blood lipids. And the paper talked about in the discussion that that was potentially due to some of the similarities in the dietary composition there. So, needless to say, we do have mixed results from similar studies. And we do need some larger, more robust studies to be able to identify specifically what works and what may not work as well in this community. I will say that that study that I just mentioned before, we did have some notable differences in our study design. So our study design for Veggie and Soul does not place limitations on plant fats from whole food. So we did not limit nut consumption or avocado consumption. We did talk a bit about coconut milk or coconut oil. We encouraged folks to steam instead of fry, things like that. But from whole foods themselves, we didn't limit that. We did place an emphasis on beans and nuts and whole grains as main protein sources, and we encouraged participants to create meat substitutes for themselves at home. So, what do I mean by that? You see from this picture here, this is a veggie burger, but it's obviously not like an Impossible or a Beyond. It's made with whole grains, it's made with black beans, etc. But we didn't eliminate that completely. So meat analogs were allowed as side dishes. And we found that this approach helped, that should say approach, this approach helped to help participants with their satisfaction of the program, because we felt as though, particularly for this community, which is like heavy meat consumption, we did not want to completely eliminate familiar flavors and textures. We wanted to teach about how to properly proportion them on the plate and introduce an alternative for those sources in plant-based forms if people would like to do that. And as I mentioned before, the role of social support could not be underestimated. Here's a study that came out last week that looked at the role of social support in helping people to adopt plant-based dietary pattern. And this study found that when there was negative social support, so when family or friends were judgmental, or they'll stick a piece of meat in your face. And I can't tell you that I've been plant-based for the past 16 years, and I can't tell you like how many times that has happened. Even if you say like, "Oh, I don't really have a taste for that." I guess sometimes folks feel like, that's something funny, right? And in communities like these, this can tend to be what's called, or what's more defined as negative social support, Whereas positive social support is allowed to happen when family and friends encourage the adoption of healthful plant-based diets. They may even try it with you, or they remind you of your health goals so that you are able to stick to the goals that you've created for yourself. And integration of this positive social support, which may come in the way of inviting family members into those interventions, inviting them to the cooking classes, inviting them to the educational lessons, that can help with positive social support, and the lifestyle intervention can be enhanced. In terms of our strengths and limitations and challenges, we did see that, again, I've said social support so many times because that was integral for us, that family interdependence, the community interdependence. And also, I think a key strength for our program, as I mentioned, the fact that we live here in this community, people didn't feel like they were talking to a stranger because they already know myself and my team as folks who do community work to help the community. So they weren't thinking of it as, here are researchers coming in to study us. They were thinking of it as, here's someone who's been helping the community, who's coming in to further help us. And that, I think, was a strength, as well as applying the culturally appropriate strategies and then being able to bring various organizations together who were doing work in food justice, community gardens, the hospital, other wellness organizations. The fact that we were able to come together to build this up, I think that was a huge strength. Of course, there were limitations. It was a very small study and randomization was not feasible. And then we did have a majority of women as participants. We do know that there are some limitations with 24-hour dietary recalls. However, we utilized that as sort of the best approach that we had at the time. And then the challenges that we have and continue to have is that, again, some of these communities are food deserts, high levels of nutrition insecurity. And then when you're talking about physical activity, many times the environments don't promote that. So we are doing work to be able to build up some of these areas that are lacking, limited funding for a grassroots program, and then being able to consistently engage the community with a small team because there aren't many other researchers who actually live here. Here are some future opportunities. Just having larger scale randomized controlled trials that include men and even oversample men. And I wanted to just show that we are continuing to do work in the community, not necessarily in measuring data through a study. However, we have ongoing cooking classes, as you can see here. We also had a recent plant-based health fest, and you can see the popular restaurant, Slutty Vegan, they brought their food truck out. We had over 250 people come out just in a span of 2 hours. So we were really busy, and you can see our table. It's my mom manning this table here. So it really is a community effort that's continuing to exist within the space of building awareness of healthy dietary patterns, integrating African heritage traditional dietary patterns, plant forward, that people are interested in. They just may not necessarily know how to incorporate it. So we're continuing to do that work. So we found that this intervention was feasible, acceptable, successful in our minds, and it does have implications for future work that's being done in this community. And the key that I'll just say is that for future work, we'd love to see more interventions that focus on incorporating culturally relevant tools and also expanding the opportunities to really integrate that within intervention. I really think that's the way forward, and that's where we'll see even more success in our work within these communities. So with that, I'll say thank you. I am open to any questions. And I just want to say thank you first to my staff. That's our motto there, eat more veggies, live with soul. That's our Veggie and Soul staff, the community leaders and the sponsors of this project. And of course, the study participants, which made it possible. So thank you again for your time. And if you do have any questions, I'm happy to take them. And if not, thank you again.
Thank you so much. This was a really great project to hear about. So one person asked, and I agree, how could we get access to the recipes?
You know, I do get that question quite a bit, and I'm happy to send out a few, because what happened was that we had those recipes on cards, and that's sort of what we gave out. And the recipes themselves, I will say, they are still, some of them are still in progress, right? So, but we're still happy to send out some recipes if people would like them. Feel free to email me. I should have put my email on this last slide, but I'll go ahead and I'll stick it in the chat in case you'd like some recipes. I'd be happy to share.
Excellent, thank you. So someone asked, you allowed coconut oil. How did you handle education about it compared to olive oil or coconut oil, for example?
Yeah. And let me clarify when you say we allowed coconut oil. So we did have education about limiting your use of oils in general. So we encouraged things like no, we did not encourage frying. We encouraged things like steaming instead of frying. What we did say was, for example, coconut milk was what I was referring to. If you use coconut milk, you may consider using the light version of coconut milk. Or if you use some full fat coconut milk, that's okay. Maybe you can just use half of it and use the rest with water or something else just to get a little bit of creaminess in the recipe. However, we didn't necessarily emphasize, use olive oil or use this type of oil. We did speak about oils, but in general, we talked about maybe limiting oil consumption. It was really more so the full fat from the whole foods themselves that we said, feel free. If you want an avocado, eat an avocado. If you want to eat a coconut, eat a coconut.
Okay, that makes sense. What do you think? You mentioned at the beginning that for Black and African American, vegetarian and vegan dietary patterns are increasing faster than the rate of the general population. What do you think is leading to this increase in choosing vegan and vegetarian diets?
I think that's a good question. And I think the answer, there are multiple reasons for that. We've seen that there's a bit of a social justice element to that. What I mean is that in many of our communities, they tend to be low resource communities. So I mentioned that we've got one hospital, one hospital. And in terms of getting into that hospital and healthcare access, people recognize that having good health is not as accessible when you live in certain communities. And so the question is, well, what can we do to help ourselves? And then when people are also looking around and seeing that there's a McDonald's on every corner, there's a liquor store on every corner, but there isn't even a health food store, it brings sort of that awareness. And then the other thing is, seeing diseases in your family. One of the things that we heard very often is people saying, I just thought my mom had diabetes, my father had diabetes, my sister had diabetes. So I guess I'm just destined to have diabetes. And when they realized that, hey, yes, there may be a genetic predisposition, but at least we can do the best that we can lifestyle-wise to reduce our risk. I think it really empowers people. And it's a movement that is building because people are coming to even more of that kind of an awareness.
Yeah, thank you. So, a comment that was posted, it just said, and I think it's a great comment. It says, "Great study. You've built trust in your community, developed partners to assist, and modeled the plant-based eating behaviors. I hope you are able to sustain the progress. It is caring researchers such as yourself who are willing to get in the weeds, so to speak, with your community that really make a difference." And I echo that. Thank you for sharing that comment, Renee.
Yeah, thank you.
And then another question. It says, "Great study and presentation. I appreciate that you took a social support approach and did not vilify familiar foods. Did you find that cooking skills as well as food access were barriers to positive change?"
I didn't find that cooking skills was necessarily a barrier, and that maybe because we had such a high proportion of women in the project, and there are still some traditional elements within this community where the women are the ones who do the most of the cooking, right? So I didn't find that as much. But definitely food access would be more of a barrier after the program. Not necessarily during the program. However, one of the ways that we tried to overcome that was teaching strategies about how not just to make your foods healthy, but cost effective at the same time. It's one of the reasons we emphasize beans and how to create beans in different ways, or oats. Like, you may not know that you can make a veggie burger using oats and pecans, you know? So we taught people ways to eat a plant-forward or plant-centered diet without breaking the bank, because we understood that food access would be something that we'd have to think about.
Yeah, thank you. And then there's another question asking where your work is published. I know you have this paper in JNEB. Is there other places people could go to find more information on this project?
Yeah, so the main paper was published in JNEB, and we are working on some others now. What I'll mention is that the work that I do is literally outside of my full-time job. So, you know, we don't have the luxury of placing that work in very many places. So the main place it is right now is in JNEB.
Well, thank you for a wonderful presentation. I really appreciate you sharing it with us, and I know you've given us a lot to think about. It's great to see a very culturally tailored presentation of an educational program. So I know I'll walk away with this having learned a lot. So thank you for your time. Paul,
Yes,
I
and thank you
can
so much.
hand it back to you.
Thank you both. Just to echo what Kristen said, very, very good work. Just a few reminders to close out today's session. Again, please complete the survey that you'll receive at the close. We do appreciate your feedback. Be on the lookout for an email with today's recording, the speaker handouts, and your CEU certificate. And if you enjoyed today's webinar, be sure to check out the upcoming webinar section of the website. Journal Club continues next Monday. And with that, that concludes today's session. Thank you everyone for joining us, and have a good day.